As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, Manchester United celebrate their first trophy since 2017. How much credit should Erik ten Hag take for their development, and what an impact Casemiro has made in their midfield? We'll also be talking about Newcastle's future, what the defeat will mean for the rest of the season and the years to come. We'll discuss the pressure on Graham Potter once again after another negative result for Chelsea. Should Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang be part of their starting lineup from here on out? And we'll examine some big results towards the bottom of the Premier League, with West Ham United winning, Leeds United as well, but defeat for Southampton and Everton. We'll also tell you who Harry Haddock is. This is The Game. Hello and welcome back to The Game Podcast with myself, Hugh Wissencroft, alongside Gregor Robertson, Tom Clark and Tom Roddy, all in the building on this glorious Monday morning after Manchester United claim a first trophy since 2017. Long overdue.
It's a good way to get people to switch off immediately, like you.
What a day, guys.
I thought you'd be going for the whole cool, woozy approach that you've been going for this season. This is nothing to get excited about, but it sounds like you've maybe still...
Is there a cool woozy?
Still drunk from last night?
No, I didn't even drink. Genuinely, this is what happened. I woke up on Sunday morning, I was philosophical. I said, you know what, even if we don't win this trophy, everything that I've wanted from Manchester United so far this season, I've had. As you all know, I wanted a team that was harder working. Absolutely, we got that. That showed, you know, that they loved the shirt and respected the supporters. Brilliant supporters that the Man United fans are. And we got that. And we got a plan. We have a footballing plan. We have a manager who can react to issues within the game and change a game. And it's all going so well that, a bit like the conversation around the title race, I don't want anything to ruin my mood. And I thought, you know what? If we don't win today, it's not going to kill my mood. I'm not going to allow it to enter the thoughts that Man United are not having a good season or they failed in any way, because everything that I've wanted has come to fruition and we're building towards something great over the next few seasons. And then I saw the Newcastle fans in London on Friday and Saturday and on the way to the game on Sunday. And I was like, I'm not having these beat us. Absolutely no way.
So you got baited into fury, basically.
Yeah, 3 days of them taking over London, swarming everywhere, singing their songs. You know, I was like, do you know what? These guys think that they are going to be ahead of Man United over the next few years. It turned into a power struggle. The old money versus the new money, even though Man United are going to have the new money soon, the newer money. The reality of the situation is, I was like, do you know what? No, we need to keep these guys down, okay? And I like the Newcastle fans as well, but it just got to me. And so by the time the game kicked off, I was like, we've got to win. We have to win. You know, it suddenly flipped on its head and I was like, we just cannot lose. So I was delighted.
Before we get into the football, which we will, so don't listen, don't stick with us, and Newcastle fans, there will be some analysis, I promise. You were there, we weren't. What did that kind of atmosphere that you've talked about over the weekend, you know, I was walking around London on Saturday and was like, my God, where are they all going? Turned out they were going to Trafalgar Square.
Yeah.
But did that kind of filter into the ground? Because Sky Sports, there was a lot of like panning to the Newcastle fans and it kind of felt like it was their day. Did that transmit in the stadium itself, like that kind of feeling of it being a Newcastle home game type thing?
It didn't feel like a Newcastle home game, but what it felt like was, and you felt it throughout, it meant more to them. You felt that inside the stadium. You know, the Manchester United fans, they all had their scarves and, you know, the songs and the sound was brilliant. The sight of the sea of red, if you like, was brilliant. But before the game, you know, as we all saw, the black and white stripes that were made by the Newcastle fans, the sound, the unison of their scarves. Even at the end of the game, even though they knew they were going to lose, the last 5 minutes or so, they all had the black and white flags. And it was just absolutely incredible from them. And they made the atmosphere really at Wembley what it was. And it was superb. You know, you had to be out there, you know, kind of half an hour, 45 minutes before just to soak it all in because you knew it was going to be special. And they made it. They did make it. And you just hope they get back there again and, you know, next time they lift the trophy because it would have been absolute carnage in London if Newcastle had won. You know, they were right up for it. And, you know, I think it was kind of a bit of a junction for them in that they felt as if it was a great opportunity to win a trophy. But they, as fans, are still feeling like, you know, with it being a 24-year gap, when will be the next time that this happens? But I think for a lot of the neutrals, you know, even Amanda Staveley, who was in the same box as me, she was like, we'll be back. In fact, she was saying, we're going to win the Champions League, we're going to win the Premier League, we will deliver what we promised these fans. I think for the fans that I met on the tube and stuff like that, they were thinking, you know, it's been so long and it might be another 24 years before we're back. I don't think that. I think Newcastle are going places. I think they showed in that final that we can take them quite seriously, particularly in terms of the cups over the next few years. So, yeah, I mean, it was a great day. Loads to still talk about. If you missed it and you don't know what we're going on about, of course, the
character... 2-0, by the way.
Exactly. Manchester United claiming a first trophy since 2017. Victory over Newcastle United in the Carabao Cup final at Wembley. It was Casemiro who broke open what was a pretty tight, tense, even turgid affair early on. Very few chances, really, in the match. He scored after 33 minutes, heading home Luke Shaw's free kick. And it was 6 minutes later after Sven Botman deflected Marcus Rashford's shot/cross out of the reach of the Newcastle debutant Loris Karius in goal, who wasn't too bad on the day, to be perfectly honest. But yeah, as I say, it was a game of few clear-cut chances. It wasn't a classic. I think we can fairly say that Man United, though, were worthy winners.
I think so, and it's interesting to hear you talk about some of those Newcastle fans, and also I mentioned that you thought it was a kind of bit of a tense and turgid game. I would agree. I don't think it was a game high on quality football particularly. And I do, it was interesting to hear you talk, and that's why I asked you about that kind of atmosphere in the stadium, because it felt like a kind of calm, experienced Manchester United side beating a slightly frenzied, manic Newcastle side at times. And obviously that's fantastic for the fans that they were like that. But it did feel a little bit like the players had got a little bit too wrapped up in the day and the moment. I think, you know, Bruno Guimarães, who's a fantastic player, slightly embodied Newcastle just being a little bit off on the day. He looked a little bit injured, as we know, you know, discussions around his fitness and things. You know, flying into challenges, whipping up the crowd, but not actually playing his brilliant game, which Newcastle need if they're going to beat teams like Manchester United in big, big, big games. And then to contrast that, for Manchester United, you have the big guy, the big game player, Marcus Rashford, delivering, and you have the superstar, Casemiro, just absolutely bossing everything. I thought his performance was absolutely exemplary and kind of a wonderful example of how the way we have this snapshot consumption of modern football is absolute nonsense. You know, before he came to the Premier League, we all thought he was this kind of S-housery midfielder who played for Real Madrid and kicked people and just sat in DM and, you know, wasn't much else to his game.
Well, DM, very modern.
Yeah, exactly. Do you know what I mean? Like, whereas he's absolutely box office, he's complete Rolls Royce, and is scoring goals as well for Manchester United. It actually reminded me a lot of the Zlatan Ibrahimovic transfer to Manchester United in terms of that kind of lifting a group of players and just being so superior. And Zlatan himself had a big game in a Carabao Cup final when he basically took United to a win against Southampton in a kind of similarly tight game. I just thought he was superb, but it did make me think that it was a slight shame for Newcastle players. I don't know whether the guys agree. It just felt like the occasion had almost overcome them a little bit, and it stopped them playing really effective football to beat United.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, Tom, because the morning of the game, Rafa Varane had done an interview in the week, and Johnny Northcroft did it in the Sunday Times, and I hadn't been sure who was going to win the game, and I read that interview and I thought, oh, Man United will win it. And the reason is because, even though, out of the two squads, you had three players who had won a trophy in English football, De Gea and Rashford on the United side and Joe Willock on the Newcastle side. Even though that was it, the Man United squad was so much more experienced. Rafa Varane had played in, I think, 21 major finals and won 18 of them, including four Champions Leagues, one World Cup. And Johnny's intro to that interview was Rafa Varane being asked, how did you pick yourself up after winning the or after losing the World Cup final in Qatar? And he thinks about it for a little bit, and then he says, well, it's a slightly easier when you've already won one. So Varane, players like Varane, players like Casemiro, it doesn't surprise me to hear Tom describe Newcastle as a bit more frenzied, because they don't have those guys who had been there and done it before. This game was always going to be billed as a beginning for both teams, whoever won it, because I do think Amanda Staveley is right in saying they'll be back. I think that was why the Newcastle fans weren't quite so downhearted after the game. I wasn't there, Hugh, but from what I was listening to and hearing, they stuck around for whereas usually at Wembley it's this bizarre feeling where half the stadium empties, doesn't it, after a final. It sounded like a lot of them stuck around. And that's because I think they do believe this is still a beginning for them. It just wasn't quite liftoff.
What were your reflections?
Yeah, I agree with that about it being like a landmark. I viewed it as a landmark for both teams. I actually almost lean towards it being more of a landmark for Newcastle. I think some of the reaction this morning has been over the top. Like, I'm not in any way diminishing the job that Ten Hag's done. He's done a brilliant job, primarily in instilling discipline and clarity in a squad that looked like it had to be torn apart. But they beat a kind of a developing Newcastle side. It wasn't Arsenal, it wasn't Man City, it wasn't Liverpool. And we've been here before. Like, Louis van Gaal won silverware, Mourinho won silverware, finished second in the Premier League. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was at the wheel, remember that? Like, we've been here before. The future is only whether what can tell us whether this is a landmark or not. And it does feel different because of the control and the sort of coherence in their play. It does feel different, but I think people need to kind of take a little step back. I don't want to be a downer here. He has done an amazing job, but some of the things I'm reading about this being the start of a dynasty and stuff, like, people need to calm down.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
People need to calm down.
I'd agree with that. I think, look, maybe people are computing, you know, other things into that. You know, if there's a huge injection of money, if the likes of Kylian Mbappe come, then maybe it's the start of a dynasty. Maybe they are reading too much into some of the other stories rather than the game.
Well, part of the problem, I think, that people need to calm down is because I still do not have the confidence in that the dysfunctional elements at Manchester United are completely cleared away.
Oh, no.
That would make his job harder, not easier.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Ten Hag is clearly an immensely capable coach and person as well. His personality has become more and more impressive in what that's done to this Manchester United team. But there's still a lot of groaning in the background at Manchester United with the sale and whatnot. So his job could be harder, not easier. And that, when you're challenging against some of the other clubs in the Premier League, talk of a dynasty is well ahead of time.
Yeah, I actually messaged the Man United mate after the game, and I said, what makes this actually quite remarkable is that I still have absolutely no faith that the people that run the club know what they're doing. Like, I actually don't, you know. It's weird. Still the same owners. All right, a lot of the people who were at the club kind of 18 months ago have left, the likes of Ed Woodward gone now. But actually, the people that have taken over, you know, aside from the fact that they were able to secure transfers for the likes of Casemiro, you know, you don't yet know whether they actually...
Not hugely imaginative.
Yeah, exactly.
He's been brilliant. We were all kind of here, is he going to be another Schweinsteiger? Everyone was like that. Mm. Everyone thought, we're not sure. Yeah, he's a hugely classy player, but he surpassed our expectations, exceeded our expectations. And then other people, you've got like Martinez, he's brought brilliant nastiness and edge and whatnot, but he's gone back to his old club to get him. He's gone back to his old club to get Anthony as well. There is still nothing much that tells me that Man United are a new club. They have a new, very capable manager.
Yeah.
And he's signed some players that have worked out.
And bear in mind, Frankie de Jong was the big target. They ended up with Casemiro, so it wasn't even the first choice. And he's been absolutely influential, and he was brilliant on the day. But yeah, I think that's that. You're right. You know, if we're going to talk about a dynasty, there are lots of questions to be answered.
I agree with everything you've said, and you know, we've talked on the podcast that, about Manchester United not being necessarily that good, you know, and you've referenced the kind of managers before, but what crucially, and this is almost a cliche, but winning a trophy buys him that bit of time to now be the next phase. You know, he made them solid, he's given them a spine, he's brought in the players that you've just referenced that have given them a bit of solidity, a bit of nastiness, enhanced that group, up players like Luke Shaw, say, who's suddenly one of the best left-backs in the world at the minute, I would say. He now signposts it with a trophy. It's almost like a kind of checkpoint in, like, say, a computer game when you reach a certain point. And
we just passed the first boss.
You know what I mean? But I'm being serious. But you know that even if you cock up after it, you're never going to go back any further. You get to pick up where you left off. He's got this now as a trophy. He's, you know, they've got the celebration pictures. They get to put up a few more pictures around the training ground, maybe, of like them winning a recent trophy. Fine, it's only the Carabao Cup, but it means that, say they finish in the top four and win a Carabao Cup this season. Say next year they go a bit loftier, but only end up finishing in the top four and don't win a trophy. He still can say at the end of next season, say 18 months from now or whatever, I've won a trophy at Manchester United. It's part of a bigger project. So I agree with everything you're saying, but the trophy buys him time to now do the next phase that you're on about, bring in some more elite players and give them more of an identity. This is like his kind of checkpoint moment.
It's interesting you mentioned that identity, because I was going to talk about it. Might as well come in here and say that we have to remember, although Erik ten Hag deserves huge credit, the first couple of games were absolutely atrocious. And that is because Erik ten Hag tried to play a totally different style of football to what Manchester United have been doing since. And you wonder if that's the dream state, you know, because in that second half, honestly, Manchester United, sequences of above three passes were virtually non-existent for about a 15-minute period.
Just clearing it long in the 55th minute. It was bizarre.
And obviously, Erik ten Hag, and we saw his team at Ajax, you know, will want to play a far better style of football. And you wonder what the recruitment will lend itself to, you know, if he will be able to bring in the kind of players that are going to dominate possession. And he can build on that. Because I thought at times, you know, against the better side on the day, Manchester United, you know, all right, it's Newcastle, they are a good side, they're a very solid side, they didn't offer much. And it's not like Manchester United ran out 4-0 winners, you know. It was, in a way, I was saying afterwards, it's not necessarily fortunate that Manchester United won the game, but there were just a couple of key moments that went in their favour. One is a set-piece goal, which really Manchester United, until that point in time, weren't the dominant force in the game. They get a free kick, Rashford along the touchline, which wasn't really that clear, looked like he got a touch. Okay, it's a free kick, gets whipped in, free header. You know, if Newcastle defend that set piece better, Man United don't score probably in the first half, because they were, you know, change the mood, if you like, inside the stadium. And Manchester United capitalised 6 minutes later through a deflected goal. And then at that point, you're like, well, it's a mountain to climb for Newcastle. What disappointed me about Eddie Howe and Newcastle in the second half in particular was they were still, I mean, 5 minutes to go, trying to play football, working passes and passes and passes. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, you're still Newcastle, you're still kind of underdogs, you're definitely 2-0 down, I can see the scoreboard, so when are we launching it, lads? When are we getting Botman in the box? When are we getting Byrne in the box? When are we going direct? What's the point in having two strikers on? Isak's a big guy. Like, guys, we can't keep passing it short. I mean, Trippier was the only one trying to cross it in, and I was just screaming, Eddie, go direct. You've got absolutely nothing to lose at this point in time.
You were screaming that, were you?
Screaming. Well, listen, I'm a fan of football. You know, what can I say, first and foremost? No, but genuinely, you know, I was sitting there going, is he going to go to wing-backs? He's going to have to change the game somehow. And I know he obviously brought on a second striker as soon as he could, but for me, you know, you've played 80 minutes. You're not passing through Manchester United. So what's plan B? What's plan C? What's plan D? And ultimately, surely they thought, what are we going to do if we're two goals down with 5 minutes left? And it wasn't going to be play the same way we've played for the other 85 minutes. I mean, there must have been another plan, and we never saw that materialise. Cause some chaos. I mean, seriously, you're shooting towards your own fans, like, get it in there. It's Newcastle.
Stick
you know,
it in the mixer.
Get
no,
it
I,
up. Them.
No, but I agree. And that's but there's something about Newcastle of late that's kind of hinted at, to that, hasn't it? They've drawn games in the Premier League where they've been left a bit frustrated. Bournemouth, West Ham, and that lack of a plan B has been evident. What Eddie Howe, I'm sure, would say, and it's kind of obvious in his quotes that Martin Hardy's written up this morning in his kind of piece that again links to a next phase almost. Howe's saying, kind of, well, pretty bluntly, some of these players won't be back to Wembley. We might be, brackets, hopefully I will be.
You know, didn't say that, funnily enough.
He didn't, but it was heavily implied, was, yeah. I felt. Yeah. It was interesting to me, you know, the kind of, we've talked a lot about like managerial PR of late with other managers. I found it fascinating that immediately after the final, it was like, some of these guys aren't good enough, you know, we need to lift it. And the implication being, I know what I need to do, I can do it, keep me in charge, we're going the right way, just get me better players. Because that's what he would say to a plan B, isn't it? That ultimately, that the starting 11 has been incredibly strong and effective at the plan A that he set out to do. But when it comes to breaking down a Manchester United side that's full of experience, and also Ten Hag as well, it was nakedly obvious, wasn't it? He stuck on McTominay, Sabitzer, even stuck on Maguire for the last five. It was proper, come on then, break us down, we're just going to sit on 2-0. Howard just say, I need more players, I need better players.
Yeah, I wonder whether he's kind of looking at it, thinking how this season could potentially unravel in the next few months. And the reason for that is because football does tend to be, and especially management, is all about context and timing. Remember when Brendan Rodgers, Leicester were going for the Champions League positions and flying high, and then the season comes to a bit of a crashing end. And similar with, look, Arsenal are doing so well now, but last season when it all unravelled towards the end, there was a real negativity around the club. You just look at the form that Newcastle are in at the moment and the games they've got to come. I can see them falling away a little bit from the top four, and that at the beginning of the season, finishing in the Europa League would have been absolutely fine. That would have been success. It would have been progress, especially because they haven't invested quite as heavily as we might have expected them to. But at the same time, I think Tom's right. That is maybe why Eddie Howe has made this point, hit it at this timing to say, essentially, get to the summer, invest in the right players, and then we will progress.
See, I thought there would have been a much stronger air of positivity about Newcastle at the full-time whistle. And I was quite surprised by it, actually, because, the fans were so magnificent. It was one of those where you thought the manager would just be turned around to the players saying, look at this, what a football club you play for, what a group of fans. We haven't, you know, given them what they wanted today. Let's make sure we get back on it in the Premier League. Let's make sure we get into the Champions League. Because he even said, you know, getting to the final has affected our league form. You know, we tried our best as a coaching staff not to let the players be distracted. And he said, but clearly it has distracted us. And I thought, wow, this is the moment that I think, all right, you haven't won the game, but you can still harness everything good about what happened at Wembley from a Newcastle perspective to say, right, we need to be back on it in the Premier League straight away. We can't allow it. We cannot allow this disappointment to affect us anymore. And I saw the players in tears, and obviously, you know, a lot of these players dreaming of winning a trophy in English football. You know, it's one of those to say, you know, chin up, we'll be back, we're playing well, we're a strong team now. You know, it's a difficult game against Manchester United. You can lose these matches, you know, but ultimately we are here going toe-to-toe with Manchester United at Wembley Stadium in front of, you know, 40,000 of our fans. Like, we need to be back here again soon. You know, it didn't feel like it was about harnessing it. Like, it felt more to me like they'd reached the FA Cup final, and it was almost like a very much end-of-season rhetoric. Like, instead of, by the way, we've got a massive portion of the season still to go, and how do we build on getting to the final of the Carabao Cup? For me, there wasn't enough of that.
I think he was throwing forward more into the future rather than looking to the rest of the season. Yeah. I think Tom's right. It was that kind of, it was an opportunity to say, we've seen our limitations today. We've seen like how far we've come, but how far we've still got to go. And that's a broader conversation than just what they're going to do for the rest of the season. So I think Tom's right. I think he saw that as an opportunity to say, look, we've come a long way, we've done some really good things here, this was a special day for the club, but we don't want to be seen as the plucky underdogs. We want to be back here regularly, like in the future. Yeah. And this is what needs to happen for that to happen.
But for me, you know, you look at the Premier League table, that's the thing, and I'm going,
well, City next as well, haven't they?
Yeah, but this is it. So for me, I'm thinking, you've got a game next week that you need to win, basically. You need to win your games in hand to be back in the top four. And that means that you cannot dwell on this. You know, there's no point talking about the summer. There's no point looking too far ahead. You know, okay, massive cliche, but the next game is the most important one. So for me, I found, you know, look, they're disappointed.
We've spoken about this before. There's a public and private sort of conversations, yeah, aren't there? I'm sure that's what will be discussed behind closed doors, but he's trying to paint a different picture in public and to the fans and probably to the owners of the club.
Still, fantastic support for Newcastle. You know, great to be inside the stadium to see it. Just wasn't to be, of course, a first Wembley visit since 1999 in the FA Cup final. Same outcome, 2-0 defeat to Manchester United. Still without a major trophy since 1969 and without a domestic major trophy since the FA Cup back in 1955. But yeah, I think it was a good day for Manchester United. I agree with you, Gregor. I don't think the dynasty is quite there yet, and I'm intrigued to see where Manchester United go in the future, particularly if they have new owners. But I give all the credit to Erik ten Hag, to be perfectly honest. You know, they said I was crazy. You know, I know he's a club legend, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, but what's it taking? A few good signings, a half-decent manager, we're back to winning trophies. You know, glory, glory. And you just can't keep us down, can you? You can't keep a good football team. Can't keep a good football team down, can you? But yeah, look, best of luck to Newcastle United for the rest of the season. Sad for their fans, but they made some great images and hopefully they had some great memories across the weekend. After this, we will be back talking about the Premier League and huge pressure on Chelsea.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, I say there's huge pressure on Chelsea, but same old story, isn't it? Graham Potter and the Blues have now won just 2 of their last 15 top flight matches. They sit 14 points off the Champions League places. I don't think there's much point talking about them in reference to that anymore. After their 2-0 defeat at Tottenham Hotspur this weekend, Tottenham 4 points ahead of Newcastle, having played 2 games more. Tom Roddy, you were at this match, and it's the same question we ask every single week. How long can this situation go on at Chelsea?
It's funny because you kind of go into these games like Spurs and think, he could lose this, it'll be fine, they will still persevere with it. But then in the moment, you actually think, I wonder if he is in trouble here. But I'm now looking at the morning of Wednesday next week. And the reason for that is because if you get to that stage and the night before Chelsea are out of the Champions League, they face Dortmund on the Tuesday night, they're 1 goal down. And that morning they could be out of the Champions League, they're already out of the FA Cup, obviously the League Cup's gone. And you said, Hugh, about not looking at the top four being 14 points off it, but it's important in context because they are so far off it. Potentially their season could be over on Wednesday morning, and that is the moment where the resolve of these owners to persevere with Potter, to believe in Potter, will be most tested. And the problem is, Borussia Dortmund, that game is very winnable. They're 1 goal down. Dortmund aren't the best team in the world at all. But in order to even draw level, in order to go to extra time, they need to score a goal, and they've got 1 in the last 6 games. They right now, they don't look like scoring, and they did not so long ago at West Ham. The only goal they scored in February, they looked really dangerous. Actually, in Dortmund, they looked really dangerous too. But the thing that I've noticed is this confidence being knocked, and it is a little bit of a domino effect because everything looked so close to clicking 2 weeks ago, and then it's unravelled very quickly. And the reason for that is because at Southampton, they make, I think it was 6 changes to the team, and it was a really woeful performance. And the pressure has mounted massively, and they go to Tottenham with the star players back in the lineup, and they look mentally fragile because any setback now they seem to really suffer. Thiago Silva going off was the spark for that yesterday. It was seen at West Ham when West Ham equalised, and they just don't seem to be responding very well. They don't seem to have much character, and that's not hugely surprising. It is basically a totally new team. It's a new manager. It's a new club, really. There's overhaul in every single department. So none of this should be a massive surprise. The problem is that history tells us it's not acceptable at Chelsea.
I mean, before they play Dortmund, they've got a home game against Leeds United. We remember the sounds of that defeat at home to Southampton at the final whistle. You can't contemplate that they will lose against Leeds next week and he survive, can you?
Well, they've also got Leicester and Everton, the other side of the Dortmund game. And I was kind of thinking yesterday, after the Tottenham defeat, with all the things Tom said about them looking so kind of directionless, and a Chelsea supporting friend of mine put it very aptly. He said that it's like watching a team who are playing like that feeling when you're trying to run in a dream and you can't. And I thought that was kind of very, very accurate.
That's a horrible feeling.
Alisson's not even here. We're getting these kind of metaphors.
Well,
unbelievable.
Someone's got to step in. But no, I thought that was really accurate because they just looked so lost and directionless, but like kind of they were trying. You know, João Felix, I thought, had all the kind of desire and running around, but it all just looked a little bit like headless chickens at times. So I was kind of thinking yesterday, will they have this moment of, okay, well, we've got a Champions League knockout tie, but we've also got 3 games where you'd kind of think these are chances to win. This is actually a great little run for a new manager, for a change, for that little bounce. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. I think Tom's probably right that they'll give him the Champions League game, but those league fixtures as well, not just the one before it, but the ones coming up after it, you're thinking this, they've got to show something in these games.
Just to say quickly that I'm not certain that going out of the Champions League would end it for Graham Potter, partially because of recent history. I think the fact that Mikel Arteta has done what he's done at Arsenal, gone from the brink, being right on the brink on Boxing Day two years ago, to now being leading a Premier League title charge, I think the owners and board will look at that and add that into the context of thinking whether part ways with Potter or not.
It's fascinating. He mentioned it, that as well, in his press conference. Tom Allnutt wrote that up in his piece from the game about Potter referencing Arteta. And when you think back to the points we've just discussed with Eddie Howe, and you're a kind of your own manager PR, they're all fighting for their jobs, aren't they, really? They're like, think of anything I can say that might reframe the conversation in the media and within our fans that might make the fans go, well, you know, Arteta did it. But I do think there's also a willingness around Graham Potter I'm not sure any other managers would be getting. Not potentially like a foreign manager who we didn't know beforehand. There's a kind of, we all like Graham Potter, don't we? Everyone likes Graham Potter.
Chelsea fans increasingly don't, though.
No, they increasingly don't. But, that does form part of the kind of fury around managers when they eventually lose their jobs, that everyone starts kind of turning. And it doesn't feel like that as yet. Even my friend who kind of came up with that analogy as a Chelsea fan hasn't been as kind of like, he's got to go. He's never said that at any point. And I feel like that's purely just because it's Graham Potter. You know, we've got a reader poll in Tom's articles on the site at the minute, and 6,000 votes saying, you know, should he go or should he not? It's 55% he should keep his job. I'm sure maybe a load of them are West Ham and Tottenham fans who are enjoying having a good laugh. But generally with our reader polls, it does seem to kind of, you know, it's football fans answering it in a genuine way. So it's fascinating that, you know, that seems to be the mood to me.
Yeah, look, I kind of agree with Tom, Roddy, that the Dortmund game after that, we'll learn a lot. I mean, if they go to the Champions League, if they don't get a positive result against Leeds, as he said, the season's over, and it's kind of, are we willing to let the season just drift and give him the summer to put his own kind of fingerprints on the squad? Because there's nothing else much to say about Potter and his situation. It's like just becoming more and more apparent that near half £1 billion that's been spent on the squad has made his job harder, not easier. And I still find it quite odd that, like, when you hear about, you keep hearing about that, and you hear they've got a squad of 33 players or whatever it is, and then you still see Loftus-Cheek playing in midfield. You still see him playing Koulibaly. Ziyech, who was just about, you know, he was in Paris. He wanted to leave, yeah. And he nearly did leave. And I think he started every game since.
Yeah, he's been poor. So, really poor.
So what, you know, I think that probably tells us something about the players that have come in, and not their qualities, but like, that it's no mean feat them settling and being ready to play in the team. In his view, it's a hard job, and I know that's not, like, you know, don't want to break out the violins for the Chelsea manager and for someone, as I say, who everyone else, you know, fans generally speaking, will look at a squad who just had an unprecedented amount of money spent on it and think, you know, how is he still in a job? But it's made his job harder. We have to kind of acknowledge that.
Just one final point to make is that I kind of referenced it earlier in that they did seem like they were getting close to clicking, and which was really impressive because it's all these superstar players thrown together. That's not easy to do. They were combining and gelling quite nicely, and then suddenly it just stopped. And Southampton last week, Tottenham yesterday, we were talking for a long time about how Graham Potter teams in general and now at Chelsea are creating XG, excellent, really high, but they weren't converting those chances. But now they're not even really creating them.
Well, I was about to move on to how I think Chelsea should play. Like, I'm stunned that now you're
going to tell them to knock it long as well.
No.
Stick it in the mixer.
No. I think once you've got Reece James and Ben Chilwell back, this is the thing that we were talking about for so long needed to happen at Chelsea. Look, you know, they don't have depth in those areas. They've been so key under Thomas Tuchel. You know, two very good players. They come back and you're thinking, right, this is it. You know, they've got to play three at the back. They're conceding goals. They're not getting enough bodies in the box. They're not creating chances. But they did plenty of that when they were playing the wing-backs. And obviously, we've seen Graham Potter play three at the back so often at Brighton that we thought it might be quite a natural thing. Yes, he also played four at the back. And when he showed up at Chelsea, he said that's how he wanted to play. They now have a raft of wingers in more of a 4-3-3 shape. You know, the likes of Sterling, they've got Mudrick in. They've brought in the likes of Madueke. Like, they've got wingers now at Chelsea. We mentioned Ziyech already, but he's not really a player that's going to play wing-back. So you're thinking, right, they have to play 4-3-3. But at the moment, I just don't see how it doesn't work better to play with the wing-backs. I've got to say it. Player that came off the bench at the weekend, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who is a goal scorer, and you don't score any goals, so he's probably got to play at this point in time, whether you like him or not. You've got João Felix, who you could even possibly play as a number 10, but if you put him alongside Aubameyang, you can get in a number 10. There's plenty of those in the Chelsea squad.
Sounds like you are saying stick it in the mixer a little bit.
No, I'm not saying stick it in the mixer. I'm saying you're going to play...
Get it in the box.
You are going to play with wide players either way, but I'm saying allow those wide players to be your wing-backs rather than your wingers.
I think your wing-back point is valid, but Aubameyang, I mean...
You don't score, Gregor, you don't score goals. You can't leave a goal scorer out.
You can.
If you don't score goals. And I mean, I'm not saying you don't win games. I'm saying you don't score any goals, mate. You don't score any goals.
They're not creating the chances. That was Tom's point. And I think, you know...
But you always look to the player who's on the bench or in the stand and say, there's the piece of the puzzle that will solve this.
Yeah.
And
we've said that about
Aubameyang so many times, and he's not done anything to impress in the team.
So
here's my question then. Who has? Go on. Who has impressed you in that Chelsea team that you think this player deserves to play ahead of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang?
João Felix.
Yeah, I mean, I would start him too.
And Havertz,
terrible.
Sterling, I'd play.
Sterling. Done nothing. done nothing.
I don't think I agree with Greg. Like, however many questions, the answer is never Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang.
Not anymore. It has been. Look, he's been a good player. He was a good player for Arsenal for a period.
He was a good player for Barcelona.
But there's
a reason. Ago.
There's a reason he's had like three transfers in the space of 18 months or something. And I think Aubameyang is not the solution.
I have an element of sympathy for Aubameyang because he joined Chelsea and then. Yeah, for Tuchel being, you know, that reunion, and then basically the morning after his first appearance back with Tuchel at Chelsea, the manager he's essentially joined for is given the boot. I agree, 13 games, 13 appearances he's made and not scored for Chelsea. He's not a goal scorer right now. He may have done in Barcelona with a point to prove, but I haven't seen it in Chelsea appearances. Even when he was scoring a few goals at the beginning, he plays on the periphery of games, and I don't think he suits the way Chelsea want to play. And actually, probably Potter wouldn't have him there if he could help it. He probably sees him as a distraction.
Why did he put him on the bench, and why did he bring him on then?
Probably because of, in a way, of what you said, Hugh, that he feels that he has to. Yeah, well, there is an element of desperation there, yeah.
Plus, keep him part of the group, bit of unity. Hmm. Like, I don't think we've seen what kind of fuss it can make when Aubameyang's cast aside and made to train on his own or whatever it is. I think if you can avoid that, then do so. You need a striker.
No,
go around the circles here.
Look in your squad and think, if I can get one of these players firing in the forward line, who's going to score more goals? So if you get Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang playing to his best, yes, it's a huge if, given what we've seen over the last year and a half. But if you can do that, he has the potential to score more goals than any of their other forwards.
Right, but
that's a fact.
Right, but again, people can talk about whether Potter should be in the job or not, but I think we should give Potter the benefit of the doubt, who sees him every day in training, whether he deserves to be playing or not for Chelsea.
Well, if you're getting results, you get the benefit of the doubt. If you can't score, why would a manager whose team score no goals get the benefit of the doubt, Gregor?
Because he's the Chelsea manager.
Yeah, but
and we're sitting here just pontificating about...
You're saying he deserves the benefit. I agree with you in that he knows much more than we know about what is going on with his squad and how they train every day and who has the potential to go out on a Saturday and perform. I agree with that. But he's on the verge of losing his job if this continues. He needs something. So for me, it's like, well, listen, he can continue to do the same thing that hasn't worked. Like, he can keep doing that if he wants to. He'll end up getting fired. He has to do something now, drastic, to change around the fortunes of Chelsea. That's all I'm saying. I'll leave it there. Anyway, let's talk about Stuart Atwell, who comes up on this podcast very rarely. I hate to name referees, but I'm doing it this week because it was odd. He gave Hakim Ziyech a yellow for a challenge on Richarlison. He was then advised to upgrade that to a red card by his assistant referee, and he did, showing the red. VAR then advised Stuart Atwell to take a look at it on the screen, and when he viewed the incident, he decided to overturn the red and give a yellow, which seemed, to be perfectly honest, like the right decision, because Hakim Ziyech clearly tried to push Emerson Royale on the shoulder. His arm then kind of rides up into his face. So it didn't necessarily mean to make contact with the face. It's a yellow card. But what really got me is that after the foul, before the incident had happened, Stuart Atwell ran over with his yellow card out of his pocket. He was clearly about to book Hakim Ziyech for the foul. So I found it very weird that yellow card was never given, but the yellow card was given for the push.
No, I don't think that was... The reason he had the yellow card out was for Kai Havertz, and there was a bit of confusion on the at that moment.
I'm confused.
There was plenty
right now
of confusion in at that moment. But of why Havertz got booked, and it was because the kind of... The melee is because Ziyech barges him, and then he gets up, and they square up and all of that. But it's actually sparked by Havertz kicking out clearly in frustration. That's, I think, what he's going to book. That's why he's got the yellow card out. And he does book Havertz.
I see.
And Emerson Royale ran in with like a shoulder barge, which then was what the push came from. I agree with you. It was incredibly confusing. But I actually think Stuart Atwell deserves huge, huge credit for not only getting the right decision, but also the putting bravery. Something entertaining in this game, which is absolutely abysmal. Honestly, I was watching it, and like it should have come with a bit of kind of comedy music in the background. Because it was a moment where he's walking around with that yellow card, Hugh, going, right, who am I booking here? Hang on, where am I going? But he got it right in the end. And like it took a long time, and it was slightly farcical. But fair play, he kind of went back and looked at it and was like, no, I'm going to get this right.
The only thing I would say is that it is another piece of sample evidence for improving the communication process. And I did a story last year, I think it was now, about how IFAB are looking to bring in a Formula One style communication of what referees are saying. So you'll hear little snippets. And that's what we needed yesterday. We needed to hear a little snippet of why Stuart Atwell was doing what he was doing, why he was giving the red card, why he was then going over to the monitor, and how they reached that conclusion. And then we might be sitting here going, wasn't that great yesterday?
Yeah. I like what F1 do, but they obviously cherry pick what we hear. I don't want those that run football to cherry pick what we hear when it comes to decisions, because, you know, it would, we might be even more confused, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'd just be happy to get to more correct ones, and they did so, as Tom says at the end. So, like, it was quite brief.
Yeah, I thought,
like,
it was
to come back
brief,
after all of that nonsense, to come back and go, sorry, yeah, that was wrong.
We just got to reflect on Tottenham's win. 4 wins out of 5 in the Premier League for them now. And it was a big win, obviously, over a rival. What did you make of them, Tom? How important is what they're doing at the moment in terms of their hopes for the end of the season?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think they had to be that good, which is the damning side on Chelsea, but we're done with Chelsea. It was impressive, and they come away from that game with not a totally stronghold on the top four, because I think they've played 2 more games, so they could lose that. But they go into a fortnight now when they can advance in the FA Cup this week. They should probably advance in the Champions League. And we're in a period where Antonio Conte's future will be decided. And it's ironic that he's been absent for this big period, and Christian Stellini has done a superb job. I don't think he wants it or will be looking for it anytime soon, but he's done a superb job in keeping them ticking over. Ironically, in that period that Conte's been away, I think they've got a real belief in what they can do. The squad has come together, and even where for a long time we were looking at it thinking Son's off the pace, and he still is. That's why he's starting on the bench. But they don't necessarily need it.
Skip's form since, you know, in the last few weeks as well, since particularly now that Bentancur's injured for the rest of the season, huge boost and a great moment for him as well.
Mm-hmm.
Although I have to say, like I said before the game, yeah, Kepa's suddenly looking like a little boy in a big goal again. Like, I know it was a great story to see him, his sort of renaissance after such a difficult Chelsea career, but. And even the second goal, like, you know, I wouldn't say it was entirely his fault. Enzo kind of tried to clear it after he blocked it initially, but he could have caught the ball. I would say essentially, although there were minor things, like marginal things, he was at fault partially for both goals.
On that second goal, I think it was, as we've talked about in our coverage this morning, it was the marking in the box that was part of an issue. I think Raheem Sterling was on Harry Kane and Mason Mount was on Eric Dier, which not sure that's the right matchup. But very briefly, going back to Oliver Skip, Tom's talked about the future of Conte, Tottenham, where are they going? Do any? I think Oliver Skip's a very good player, but I don't know whether he's like a top 6 midfielder for Tottenham going forward. And maybe in that role, we've talked about in midfield, they've looked light at times this season, very reliant on Kulusevski and then Bentancur. Tom, do you see him as a future Tottenham superstar, or is it a little bit more like, say, Scott McTominay at Manchester United, where he can be a good squad player, but he's not your answer to your problems?
I don't think many players in that position tend to be superstars, but I think he has the potential. He's only just 22, so it's a really important time for his career, because he went to Norwich on loan and was a superstar there. He was the reason they went up. They got promoted that season, and then you saw the difference in quality when Billy Gilmore goes there. And he sort of had a bit of a little bit of a setback this season, really, because they've gone in and invested in Bentancur and Yves Bissouma. And if you're Skip looking at that, you're thinking, well, I'm not the future of this club. So, and the problem is, at a club like Tottenham, where the manager has changed so frequently, we hear players talk about it. I've got to impress that guy. Now I've got to, and I make progress with him, and then there's a step back and I've got to do it all over again. It's that instability which isn't healthy for players who are developing. Yes, I think he can do it at Spurs. Will he? I don't know right now.
Instinctively, I would put him in the McTominay camp, but he's got a chance now. It's up to him.
If he gets that opportunity and he gets a run in the Premier League, he's playing for a big side with good players, he has the ability as a young player to make a leap.
Yeah. The other thing is that because I've seen this ever since Conte took charge at Tottenham, is that he wants a midfielder who can pass the ball, and I'm not sure Skip is that level of passing, and Højbjerg isn't either. So that's going to be a
but it's whether really he can be an able deputy to Højbjerg or one day take that role himself. We don't think Skip is going to be, you know, the deep lying playmaker in Tottenham's midfield. But it's whether he can be the ball winner. It's whether he can be the energy in the engine room, really. I think he can do that, but, you know, I think about players who, obviously, as a Man United fan, who kind of surpass their talents. You know, you mentioned Scott McTominay, but immediately I think of a Tom Cleverley or a Darren Fletcher. I mean, Darren Fletcher, okay, and Tom Cleverley, probably better all-round footballers, but, you know, Cleverley leaves Manchester United, he's not the same player. Fletcher leaves Man United, he's not the same player. They're in a club that worked for them, given their histories with the academy, and I'm just saying that Skip might fall into that category at Spurs. They might get more than the sum of his parts, if you like. So, look, it was great to see him score that goal. Great. I was watching Match of the Day last night. You know, just looks like a genuine kid, you know, speaking on the touchline afterwards in his sliders. So I enjoyed that. And, yeah, great afternoon for him. OK, all right, up next, we'll talk about the bottom of the league. And we'll hear about Harry Haddock at Grimsby. If that's a name you don't know, stay tuned. Well, the bottom of the table, I think at the moment, is worth examining each and every week. Three clubs to focus in on. Danny Ings, first two West Ham goals. They beat Nottingham Forest 4-0 at the London Stadium. Leeds move out of the Premier League's relegation zone as Junior Firpo's second half goal gives them a crucial victory, 1-0 over the bottom club Southampton. It was Javi Gracia's first game as manager, Ruben Selles' first game as their new permanent boss. And Everton lost 2-0 to Aston Villa at home. Ollie Watkins has now scored in five straight league games for Villa. But we start with that big win for West Ham. Who would have thought it, going back to my point on Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, found a formula by putting a finisher in their team.
You're not claiming this.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. How did David Moyes manage this? He put someone who likes to score goals in his team. And guess what? He didn't play that well. And guess what? He scored twice. Well, good finishes as well. Well done, Danny Ings.
It definitely is credit to the Game podcast for this one, but it's not credit to you, Hugh. It's David Moyes has definitely listened to Tony Cascarino, who on last week's show talked about it being a slightly strange decision to sign a goal scorer like Danny Ings and not put him in the team. But he did that, and there were stories beforehand about this being the second time this season that Moyes was going into a game thinking if he loses, he could be out. Gary Jacob wrote in the Times this week about that being the case. So as a manager, he reacted. He changed system. He played players who haven't always had a consistent run, like Benrahma. He also moved Paqueta into a more advanced role. Gary Jacob's done some analysis this morning on the website about that. But it meant that it was all kind of geared towards Danny Ings getting in the box and getting service. And that's where the two goals came from. I think Ings himself deserves a lot of credit, particularly for that first goal. He kind of starts the move. And then just the striker's desire to get in and around the six-yard area to finish that chance is massive. What will be interesting now is whether Moyes continues that. So continues with that system, continues with players like Benrahma going into future games. Because obviously, you know, they were at home to a team like Forest, who were also down in the bottom half of the table with them. Kind of it was a gimme in that sense. To go for it a little bit more. Whether he'll keep doing that is what will probably decide whether they kind of just keep yo-yoing in and out of form.
Seems like it was a bit of an odd game, though. I mean, I think in Bill Edgar's column today, he said it's the first time in a decade there's been a 4-0 when it was 0-0 going into the final quarter of the game. Like, it was, West Ham deserved the win. They were dominant. They had, you know, 18 shots to 8. Forest looked like they were off their game a little bit. But it was a kind of barnstorming end. Mm. And desperately needed for Moyes as well. Moyes needed that very much, and he needed goals. We've spoken so often about the teams down there who are struggling for goals desperately. And as you say, you know, whether he listened to the game or not, Danny Ings was the answer in the day. And as he said afterwards, he was even a bit upset he didn't get more. Because in that kind of final period of the game, they were absolutely tore through Forest at will.
I'm not quite totally convinced they've turned to the corner, West Ham, though, because of what you said, Gregor, about Forest. They were actually awful in that final period. They surrendered midfield, stood off West Ham. Also, with putting a goal scorer into the team, Steven Gerrard at Aston Villa had two great goal scorers, Danny Ings and Ollie Watkins. It didn't work out. And that was because those two players working together didn't gel. It didn't suit a system. Whereas I think it does at West Ham with Danny Ings on his own. I think Ollie Watkins is doing well at Villa now without that trying to crowbar them together. West Ham have now got 6 games in 19 days. So I hope for David Moyes' sake and West Ham's sake it is a turning point. But this is going to be a real tough period for that squad.
Danny Ings obviously stole the show, but Jared Bowen, I think, was the star. And invariably, when West Ham win or when they, you know, they play at their best, Jared Bowen is at his best. I think he's still the most important player. Like Ben Rama, as Tom mentioned, he's kind of played in fits and starts. I think David Moyes tears his hair out over him sometimes because he knows he's got so much quality and he can be a great player for them, but doesn't do it on a consistent enough basis. Jared Bowen has not been the same Jared Bowen this season that we've known, you know, in previous years at West Ham. But still, he was in great form in this game, and I think, you know, having him playing at his best is going to be really important for the rest of the season there.
Okay, good win for West Ham United. Elsewhere in terms of the bottom of the league, massive, massive win for Leeds United. Javi Gracia was praised for being a calming influence for Leeds United. It was a pretty frantic game, though, in the end. Is that how they're going to play, do you think, from here on out?
It's frantic Leeds, isn't it?
Yes.
I thought Grassi was an excellent appointment. I think there's a lot of revisionism that can come in with former Watford managers, just the assumption that they're all rubbish, but it's just purely because they all get sacked after 18 months or so. But what he did at Watford...
Days,
weeks.
He's the longest serving of the Pozzo era.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And he got them to an FA Cup final and a mid-table finish in the Premier League in one his full season. So I thought perhaps we were going to get a bit of a calming effect, but it doesn't seem to be the case. You know, it was absolutely frantic. It was like they'd won a cup final when they scored. So, I mean, maybe that's smart from him, because to unpick all that at Leeds would take probably years to get them to be calm. So you just don't know. We've said it with West Ham. Are they going to be consistent? Maybe with Leeds, with this new manager, they might be, but they will seem to be consistently frantic.
It's the quickest a new manager bounce started and a new manager bounce ended in one game. On the Southampton side, who knows, Ruben Selles, he could end up being the Jose Mourinho who steps out from the back and becomes a great manager. But my immediate thought is that it's a little bit of maybe immaturity from a new ownership. I thought the Nathan Jones appointment, it's easy in hindsight, but it was strange for a club like Southampton in a period they were in. And even now, they beat Chelsea from a James Ward-Prowse free kick. It hasn't convinced me that they'll stay up. Whereas I look at Leeds and think that they have enough quality in their squad. I actually don't think it matters too much with whether Ruben Selles is going to be great or not. I don't think Southampton have enough quality.
I tend to agree, to be honest.
I just think there's so little between 7 teams at the bottom. And a lot of it is to do with goal scoring. As Tom mentioned there, Ward-Prowse free kicks have been kind of saviours for Southampton, really, in a number of games. And Leeds' goal was really... I mean, it was well worked move in the corner, but the finish was like I think it was Bednarek kind of stood, like, tried to get out of the way, and the goalkeeper was unsighted and still should have saved it. It was really scrappy finish. I quite liked that. Firpo's interview after, though, he was great English and, like, really kind of bubbly and saying, I used to play as a striker and then I was a left winger and then a left back, and I thought that makes sense because you're not a defender. No offence, but I was pleased for him, really pleased.
Who killed him?
Who's your seventh team, by the way? Because the point I was going to make, and I kind of already half made it in terms of the teams down there, is that, you know, Leicester lost to Arsenal. Great win for Mikel and the boys. Well done, lads. But, you know, Leicester are down there, only 4 points above Everton. Palace. I know Palace fans are pretty worried about their form. I know they've got a draw against Liverpool and another awful game this weekend. I've already mentioned it far more than I should have. Forest have had a good run. Cooper's made them a bit more solid, but that was a pretty damning result. Yeah, who's your seven?
You're right. There's nine, really.
Isn't it?
No, I would say there's even five and four.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like, to West Ham and down. So you've got West Ham, Leeds, Everton, Bournemouth, and Southampton. Not a great deal between them. And then you've got Wolves, Leicester, Forest, and Palace. And they seem, you know,
a little bit
above them. Mm. And you've got a little bit more belief that they can string enough results together to pull clear. But I'm not like totally confident about it. I think Forest could still drop back. I think Leicester have had a big boost from the few signings they made in January, but still. And then I was at Wolves, Fulham on Friday, and Wolves were brilliant in the first half. Mm. Absolutely brilliant. And then Fulham really upped their game in the second, and they could have lost the game. I'm still not totally confident enough that they're going to keep enough clean sheets and score enough goals. Sarabia scored a goal. That's a rarity for a forward. Jimenez skewed a header wide. He's not scored in a year. Like, it's all about goals, and Wolves are really struggling for them still.
I went to Fulham Wolves, so it's amazing in that stadium that we didn't bump into one another. Particularly through the press room. Yeah,
Gregor said he saw you and looked the other way, mate.
I got late train back from Grimsby, actually, so I'll speak of that later.
Let's quickly talk about Everton. Just Sean Dyche saying that they never found the killer moment. 15 shots in the game, beaten 2-0 by Villa. Good chances too. A couple of them for Neil Mopay, one for Alex Iwobi. And we basically saw why they've only scored 17 goals in 24 league games, the lowest in the league.
Are you going to make a striker point, get it in the box again? Because this is the theme.
No, I mean, look, the strikers that we were talking about.
No, but in fairness,
Aubameyang would probably start Everton, wouldn't he?
Maybe. you do make a good point, and I think that's the counter Sean Dyche argument, where you're like, okay, you need to maybe put another attacking player in there, because there was a few. I think Mopay played quite well. Obviously, missed some chances, but there was a moment in the first half where he kind of creates a breakaway on his own, gets kind of to the left. Like corner of the area, looks up and there's no one to pass to, and even then waits for Dwight McNeil to overlap him. McNeil puts a cross into the box, and I think he was looking for Iwobi, fine, you know, a midfielder who can score goals, but then the other options were charging in at the back post, Seamus Coleman and Doucouré. You've not necessarily got people with goal scoring instincts there, and obviously Dyche is going make us solid 4-5-1, but that is in these games when you're playing against a team where at home maybe you'd be thinking we can try and get a result here. You maybe need to, like David Moyes at West Ham, put some more attacking impetus in there.
Okay, all right. It's busy at the bottom of the league. We'll be revisiting this. Bournemouth, by the way, outplayed by Manchester City at home, losing 4-1. We mentioned Wolves drew at Fulham, Leicester beaten by Arsenal. That means 6 points separate Crystal Palace in 12th and Bournemouth in 19th. So there is a long, long way to go in terms of relegation. So we'll have to keep a very close eye on it. Gregor, before we go, tell us about Harry Haddock.
Harry Haddock, big inflatable fish.
I bet no one saw that coming.
They
all thought it was a journeyman striker. Someone Gregor.
Well, he was actually. There was a Harry Haddock who played for Clyde, Scottish footballer back in the day, as one commentator below the line pointed out today in my piece. Because there was just that was the intro to my piece. Grimsby are playing Southampton in the FA Cup there on Wednesday. They're the lowest ranked team left. It's the first. Appearance in the fifth round since 1996, I think. And there was a little moment a couple of weeks ago where after they just got through, Southampton said, "Oh, Grimsby, this is their mascot, Harry Haddock. They've taken him everywhere, to every biggest game since 1989. They played Wimbledon at the Old Plough Lane. 2,000 of them were waved around in the air, and Des Lynam produced one from under his desk a match of the day later. So it was like a nice little feature. And so that's the kind of their mascot. And Southampton came out and said, no inflatables allowed. So there was a bit of an outcry, a few puns, what a load of pollocks. soulless, no place for fun in football anymore, etc., etc. And within 24 hours, they realised they might have made a mistake. So they're allowed. So Harry Haddock is going south on Wednesday. And it's a big game for Grimsby. They've twice dropped out of the Football League, one of which I helped in my last year as a footballer.
Humble brag, well done. I was wondering if you were going to get
back
that
in. Helped him get back in. And Paul Hurst, who was the manager when I was there, has since gone back after a good time at Shrewsbury and a difficult time at Ipswich. And I drew a bit of a parallel between what's happened between him at Ipswich and Nathan Jones, who's obviously just left Southampton, and that two kind of managers have worked in the lower leagues, put in a lot of hard yards to get a rare opportunity in a higher league, albeit in the Championship in Hurst's case. And it was gone. It was taken away in 14 games. Both 14 games that were gone. So he spoke about how hard that is after working so hard. But he knew he'd get another opportunity, and he's gone back to Grimsby, and it's a good fit. And he hauled them out of the National League last season at the first attempt. Remarkable playoff campaign where they beat Notts County with a 96th minute equaliser and then an extra time winner. Then they beat Wrexham, obviously Hollywood funded Wrexham, that's the prefix you have to give, in a 5-4 classic with an extra time winner. And then they won in the final against Solihull Moors with an extra time winner. So they're not short of spirit, and they also equalised to take Luton to a replay in the last round, and then blitzed them 3-0. So who knows, maybe a shock on the cards, and there'll be plenty of happy Harry Haddocks if so.
I got to say, you guys know I love looking at a draw, and I think it is a great draw for the FA Cup fifth round, which we will react to on Thursday. But there's going to be some surprise names in the quarterfinals, whether we like it or not, because as you mentioned, Southampton play Grimsby, Burnley will play Fleetwood, for example. You've got Fulham and Leeds, one of those will be in the quarterfinal. Bristol City taking on Man City, tough one for them. Stoke against Brighton, never know with some changes, and Leicester against Blackburn as well could go to the away side. So hopefully some giant killings in the FA Cup, which we'll react to on Thursday. Fingers crossed for Harry Haddock and the crew that Grimsby can make it through as well. Thank you all for listening, gentlemen. Thank you for being such great company, Gregor and the two Toms. Remember, if you want to read some of the great journalism from the weekend, looking ahead to the FA Cup, looking back on the Carabao Cup final and the weekend in the Premier League, make sure you check out today's game. You can get that from a newspaper, of course, so pick up a paper if you're passing a shop. If not, make sure you check it out online. You can get the Times app as well and subscribe online. thetimes.co.uk/thegame. We'll see you on Thursday. Take care.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.